Giles Brown. Let's talk.
Elizabeth was king, then James was queen. That was ascribed to an unknown English author in 1603. Talking about James Stuart, King of England, Scotland and Ireland. He didn't always love life wisely, but he never failed to do so badly. His life has been documented in recent TV series, but my goodness, this book unearths a real kettle of fish, a real can of worms. It is the subject of a new book called Queen James, The Lies and Loves of Britain's First King. It's by Gareth Russell. And I'm delighted to say that Gareth Russell joins us live on the line now. Gareth, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure's all mine. Is this all rutting in a rough? What's going on here, Gareth?
It is some saucy cod pieces, yeah.
Indeed.
So it is. He was a pretty, he had a high libido, and he also, I think, really sort of was a serial monogamous. He kind of loved being in love. Mm. And he was a brilliant political tactician. His mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, had been overthrown. His son Charles I lost the Civil War and was beheaded, and in the middle is James, who dies, on the throne and in his bed. So he was someone who could navigate politics. But when it comes to his private life, he wasn't really prepared to hide things away. So it's an extraordinary life.
Because I mean, most of you think, okay, so he's James I of England, James VI of Scotland, correct? And this is a schoolboy history, yep. Right? Bible comes into it, obviously. Yep. And also, hey, gunpowder, those wild and crazy Catholics in the gunpowder plot.
Yeah, it's from a biographer's perspective a dream. You have really, multiple assassination plots since he was a child. He's kidnapped many times before he really assumes control of the Scottish government at 17. He was someone who, he describes himself at one point as being nurtured in fear. He was brought up with the fear that he would end up like both of his parents, who had died violently and for political reasons. And he's always, I think, someone who is trying to avoid that, understandably. But along with being, someone filled with, I try not to say paranoia, because if they're constantly trying to kill you, it's actually
just, exactly is.
It's not paranoia, it's an accurate fear. And also, an intellectual powerhouse. He loved languages, he loved theology, he had played a big role in the King James translation of the Bible. But he also writes these sometimes very sexually explicit, sometimes really romantic letters to a series of male favourites who sort of form the backbone of the book. That's the device through which I tell a story.
So can we say that he's a man of passions? Because he's passionate about many things. Okay, his love life, but he's passionate, as you said, about he's like the complete man. This is like Renaissance stroke between the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. We don't sort of think, but in the same way, he's passionate about bringing together, because this is the first king of Britain, and a lot of people, because we look back now sort of 400 years later and we just think, oh yes, fine, it happens during the rugby, but this is a huge thing. He is the king of Britain, which also involves across the water. Scotland has been nitpicking and biting at England since Edward II, who also had an interesting love life. So therefore
Yeah, he is. The great bookends. He is in many ways is the first unionist. He's the first person who really pushes the idea of a union of the British Isles. And he is fighting uphill. I mean, the English absolutely loathe the idea initially. They are really aghast that the name of England will be replaced by Britain. The Scots aren't too keen on it, really setting the pattern for what will come. Half the Irish are keen on it and half of them really aren't. So he's someone that I think that you can see in his life. Yes, describing him as a man of passions is a brilliant way to do it, because he doesn't think about his politics or his personal life or his religion by half measures. Everything, he feels love and hate very, very strongly.
Let's not paint him as some sort of ahead of his time guy, because he can be absolutely ruthless and brutal. There's witch hunts. There is what happens to. And I always go on about that because people say, because I'm living in Spain, which is just a bit Catholic, and people always ask me over here, why don't they have bonfire night over here? And I was like, okay, a couple of reasons why we don't celebrate Guy Fawkes. Yeah, exactly. exactly, Garrett. No, honestly, I've had that asked to me by some expatriates, shall we call them. And, you know, I remember as a child going around, because I'm from the Midlands, sort of Staffordshire area, and we'd be taken around these stately homes, as you did, dragged by your mum too, and it was like find the priest hole, find the hidden, and we thought this was great fun. We thought this was really entertaining, and bookshelves that pull, but you don't actually realise the full horror of what happens when the plot goes, and the devastating effects.
Couldn't agree more, because I think I don't believe anyone's ahead of their time, really. I think we tell ourselves that, so I completely agree with you. He was someone who believed completely that God had picked him to be king. And actually, in fairness, you know, I know many Christians today. I mean, a friend who was involved luckily not a terrible car crash, but he was like, oh, well, God saved me. And I was like, well, if you believe that, I mean, the idea that God manifests your destiny is something that many people still believe. But he does believe in witch hunts. He initially thinks he's not stupid. He's like, if you torture someone, they're probably going to tell you what you want to hear. But then he starts to attend the interrogations. He gets spooked by what he hears, and he becomes for about 10 years a full-throated believer that Satan is walking the earth, and that in particular sort of what we would call voodoo magic has been used to harm him. And he's also, he at one point he tells an Irish delegation, I would rather the blood was up to our knee than we granted toleration to Catholicism. So he is very, very much someone who is a product of a really, he's not the only one. They all are. It's an literally, not to use the gunpowder pun, but an explosive time, religiously and politically. And unfortunately, it is a case of strangle or be strangled many times.
Terrifying time to be alive, because as I said, you know, it's not paranoia if they are out to kill you. The belief in the fact, I mean, this is the divine right of kings, which would lead to the death of Charles I, but also that real belief that Satan walks among you, and you have to, you have to stamp these things out. And therefore, how does he therefore marry, if you like, his again, we'll call him his passion, shall we? Because it's not even 12 o'clock yet, and people might be on their second cafe con leche over here.
It's a great question. And actually, it's one of the things that, yes, I think him being in love with men and writing some actually quite beautiful love letters to him is something that makes him immediately relatable to a generation like ours, in which there is much more knowledge of and acceptance of homosexuality. But the really important thing to remember is that he will never see it in the way that we see it. And one of the crucial components of that is James will never see homosexuality as big of a problem. So for today, in many Christian circles, you know, I grew up Presbyterian, and the issue of homosexuality is one of the biggest.
Yeah.
And the idea that you have to choose between one and the other is one idea that our generation might recognize. In the 1500s and the 1600s, homosexuality will be classed in the same way as adultery, or it will be classed in the same way as greed or spite. So James is able to reconcile it with his Christianity in the way Henry VIII or Charles II were able to reconcile being in love with someone who wasn't their wife with also being a Christian. They just don't quite see it as the kind of Rubicon that we tend to when it comes to religion.
Does he also get a free, and excuse the word, say, does he also get a free pass, as it were, because he is a royal? He is out of aristocracy, therefore he is assumed to have, you know, he is pretty close to God's waiting room. So therefore he's got this, because it's divine right of kings, he's got a direct contact. And let's face it, you know, he's not the first. I mean, we mentioned Edward II with his favourites. You know, not only Gaveston, but also
Spencer.
Thank you. And of course, we've got Richard I, who basically spends most of his time in bed with the French king. We know when he's getting Aquitaine back. So it's not the first time that it's a true story. They shared each other's plates. They shared each other's beds. So it's not the first time. So is it more acceptable for him? And does he, to use a common expression, does he flaunt it, or does he rub it in people's faces? Because I imagine the bishops aren't too happy about this.
The bishops aren't wild about it. The Presbyterian Kirk in Scotland are really not pleased. Although they get really angry when a man is bad, a Catholic man is twice as bad. Oh. I mean, the absolute They absolutely lose their mind at that point. But and really, the what's going on in the bedchamber is second to their list. They're like, he's going to use his body to trick the king into becoming a Catholic, which is a novel approach to how to conversion. But yeah, there is, I think there is an element, a large element to which it is looked askance at because he is king. And really, the pushback only comes if the lover moves from the bedchamber into the council chamber. That's when the problems start. The other thing that they have problems with, sometimes it's the nationality. They don't like if it's a Scotsman. The English tend to get quite annoyed about that. As I say, the Protestants don't like a Catholic. But also, one thing that we have to remember is, and this fascinated me when I found these sources, there are people who don't know what homosexuality is. And that seems baffling to us. I mean, there are people from maybe the countryside visiting court or their lawyer, people who just have never encountered it. And they describe seeing James kissing the neck of a duke or throwing himself into one of his lover's arms. And they actually don't know what they're describing. One of them says, His Majesty seems to have mistaken their gender and is treating them as ladies. So there's fascinating moments of just what the complexity of attitude to sexuality was at the time.
Yeah, but not only that, because of the way the court is structured as well. I mean, you're going to spend an awful lot of time with men, you know, because women, because you marry for political alliance. You're betrothed at the age of 8 to a 6-year-old from Saxony or where they're from. You know, for a Sax. There's a Sax Coburg spree. I'll have that one.
Absolutely, you know, have a Sax Coburg.
Exactly. So you're not sort of. You don't spend an awful lot of time with women, and it's a time. I know we're talking the 17th century here, but we're only a few generations away from your time of combat and men doing, to paraphrase Monty Python, men doing manly things and you know, spending all their time together.
Yeah, exactly. So the court is homosocial long before it's homosexual. So, you know, even the queen, she will be, all her close friends are women. And so it takes when you're researching it, and you have to wait until they start to specify a particular man. So it takes actually probably, I would guess, it took them longer to notice. So you have to wait until the sources are really abundant before you can make a conclusion, because he will be surrounded by men. And it's only when in that environment someone notices it as unusually close that you can describe that for the reader. Because otherwise, as you say, that's just the world they live in.
So, I mean, is this going the rounds? I mean, it's not making pamphlets. Is it the subject of courtly gossip? I mean, how does this come to... I know there's been a TV series and TV, and everybody's gone, wow, fantastic. Oh, who could have thought it? And that's written, maybe, I haven't seen it because I don't have a TV, believe it or not. So that has made, obviously that's been done perhaps in a 21st century way. I mean, is this remarked upon at the time? And where, Gareth, do you begin with your, it sparks interest and go, you know what, we've got four characters, you know, the king and his three main lovers.
Yeah, so you start, I mean, I think there are, you're right, it very seldom makes the pamphlets. There are a couple of interesting flashpoints where it becomes really obvious and it does seep into public discussion, but only once do they outright say it. But in the court, what is remarkable is they're very open about it. So I tried as much as I could to stay away from the public pamphlets, because they are just repeating gossip, and there will be times, more times than not, they'll get it wrong. So the start is really to look at the private letters that have survived. And fortunately, as you say, we're just beyond the period of manly men doing manly things. But more importantly, we're into the period of people starting to preserve letters. And we do know that some of his most, let's say, biologically specific letters, not all of them, but a lot of them were thrown into the fire by the Lord Chief Justice when he found them accidentally during an investigation. And he remarks later, he makes a comment about the sodomy laws and then says, oh, by the way, you know, I once threw a bunch of the king's letters into the fire, which is a very interesting sequitur. But it is the intimate correspondence of them. So sometimes you try to get as close as you can. So for me, I think there might have been others, but you have to be careful of not being too speculative. So what I did with the lovers I write about is, I made sure that there were people very close to them. So lawyers who were friends with them, fellow aristocrats who were friends with both. And if they are talking about it and in what they thought was correspondence that would never see the light of day, that's a good source. The best, obviously, are the letters between James and the favourites themselves, some of which, particularly some of the later ones, are very moving. And there's one where sort of the relationship is falling apart, that this could be written by anyone about what it's like when you feel love kind of breaking apart in front of you and you can't quite figure out how to put it back together. It's very human.
And the other thing is the fact that, you know, love, we talked before about having, you know, marriage is for strengthening alliances, for keeping, you know, getting influence in Europe, etc. But his love is different. His recreational love is different. And so therefore he couldn't have picked in terms of alliances. I mean, we've got, well, what have we got? You know, a Highland Earl for a start. So that's the Scots getting thing. We've got an English spy and then we've got the Welsh. And, you know, it's again, and people overlook this, you know, March of Lords, etc. is only, again, it's only 200 years previous to this.
Well, there's these sneering comments from the Howards who are snobbish about everyone, but they will only refer to Philip as the Welsh Earl in their correspondence. They absolutely hate him. But he's sort of, you know, brawn rather than brain. But he's unionist in his love life as well. He does the rounds of Britain. And it is, it's just from a biographer's perspective, it's a dream. I will say, actually, his wife, Anna, she makes her peace with this, Anna of Denmark, and she actually ends up helping to pick some of the later romances, because it's she grew up with her mother, Queen Sophia, was constantly sort of humiliated by her husband having his mistresses and illegitimate children parade around the Danish court. And Anna's quite pragmatic, you know, in return for almost literally a blank check to fund her art collection, and she never met a jewel she didn't think she would look good in. But she's a really savvy political player, so she sort of said, well, if this is the reality, actually it might be better for me than him having affairs with women.
Well, not only that, I mean, you look at some of the things that happened to previous royal wives. I mean, violent, you know, violence is part of the course. You mentioned illegitimate children. I mean, Isabella gets, you know, so many of them get thrown into Eleanor Aquitaine, Isabella, you know, they get 10 to 20 years in prison. And I mean, it may be a country house and something like that, but it's still, they are still locked away. They can't do their own thing. So she's gone, you know what, on a balance of things, you know, as you said, this isn't such a bad, and she's Danish. So, hey, you know.
She probably is one of my favorite people to write about this. I mean, there's some, they become really good friends, and they have these really catty letters to each other in which they're sort of making fun of a 70-year-old Earl who's marrying a 20-something socialite. And you know, James says, by the way, I'm just telling you about this so you don't laugh out loud when they tell you, and don't tell anyone until they say it. And she writes back and says, I won't tell anyone, Your Majesty, as long as you tell me how to keep a secret. I've already told you everyone I've come into contact with. So they're quite, there's a real rapport between the two of them. And you're right, I think she's very aware that given what other royal women go through, this is not a bad deal for her.
One of the things that strikes me as well is the fact that we have correspondence that we can sort of relate to, like you said, because previously a lot of it is you know, letters to so and so, and thou will, and yes, and again, our monks get involved, and you know, the chroniclers, and they've got an agenda. We talk about, you know, fake news and mainstream, but you know, the monks who are writing correspondence or writing about this, they always have an agenda, and every woman is this, that, and the other. So it must be fascinating for, as a 21st century chronicler, Gareth, to actually read this and go, this is making me laugh.
And laughing was not on my bingo card for Times in the archives, but their letters did make me laugh. They were both very witty. And you're right, it is a marvelous time in history to write about, because you're at that period where more of the letters are surviving. And, you know, yes, we have like really specific accounts of the interrogation into Queen Catherine Howard. You have Henry VIII's love letters to Anne Boleyn, but they are outliers in terms of that level of intimate detail. And to have, you know, everyday letters and to have and jokes, and that amount of source work is a delight for a biographer. And it becomes, obviously, as you go into the 18th and 19th century, more and more survives as well.
Did you find it put colour onto, and I'm not saying it wasn't colourful enough, but again, we think gunpowder plot, you know, the James Bible and Scotland and England, sixth and the first. So did you find yourself putting more colour on him, and that's what you hope that people will take from the book?
I hope people do take it from the book, because having that amount of his own words and the words of the people he loved and who he was related to, as well as family, it means that you can see him from the interior. All those really important things, the union, the attempt at the union, the gunpowder plot, the Bible, they're, and the witch hunt even, they're really seeing James from the outside. It's an outsider's perspective. And so to be able to write it from the perspective of him and the people he was closest to, I hope readers do take that immensely colourful life with them.
You see, here's the thing, and this is the last one. I just thought of this, because we would now think of somebody who's wrestling with their sexuality in that way as being a tortured soul. It's always the whole thing. Do you think he actually gave a what's it about, and just thought?
No, he doesn't ever seem to have agonized about it at all. There was no. I mean, I don't even know if the closet door was ever closed, but he was not someone who really sat. He did not wrestle with his conscience about this. If he did, he hid it very, very well. No, I don't think he was someone who felt sort of grief or anguish or distress about it.
The book is called Queen Jack. I'm just loving the fact that, you know, while he's having this whale of a time, we've got these sort of very dour, austere sort of Catholic kings in Spain who are getting cold in their cloisters in Toledo going, ooh, you know. Anyway, the book is called Queen James, The Life and Loves of Britain's First King. It's by Gareth Russell, who we're speaking to today. Gareth, if people want to find you online, tell me there's an Instagram account or some social
there
media.
Is,
where can they find you, Gareth?
There is _ Gareth Russell verified is my probably the best place to find me, and I have a podcast, Single Malt History.
Wonderful. And you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore, and I urge you to, because I love my history. The book is called Queen James. It's by Gareth Russell. Gareth, it's been you see, royalty and rough and rutting, that's what you need on a Wednesday. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Charles, I appreciate it.